Good evening, welcome, and thank you for joining us for the 30th season of River Styx at Duff's. Tonight we feature two musical and versatile writers, Cincinnati poet Don Bogan and Kansas City poet Michelle Boiseau, both of whom have books for sale courtesy of Left Bank Books right over there in that corner table. I'm going to get off the podium here, and I'm going to introduce the introducer of Don Bogan, Allison Funk, whose most recent book is Not Garden. Allison teaches at SIU Edwardsville in the Graduate Creative Writing Program, and she's also the editor of Sou'wester. Please welcome Allison Funk.
I think it's the first time I've used my new glasses to. So, I first met Don Bogan. Yes, thank you. I first met Don Bogan about 10 years ago at a conference of the Associated Writing Programs. Nearly every year since that first meeting, we've sought one another out at the AWP's annual conferences. And with each meal, each conversation we've shared, I've come to more deeply value Don's thoughtfulness as a friend. It's that quality of thoughtfulness that I think I value most in his poems as well. Poems that have won him awards from the National Endowment for the Arts, the Poetry Society of America, the Camargo Foundation, and the Ohio Arts Council, for example. These same poems, published originally in such places as the Paris Review, The Nation, The New Republic, and the Yale Review, have been gathered into two books from Wesleyan University Press, After the Splendid Display in 1986 and The Known World in 1997. Most recently, Wesleyan has published his third book, Luster, a book that is thoughtful in every way, every sense you can imagine. The mind of the book, if I can call it that, is contemplative, attuned to the nuances of ideas. And the heart of the book is deeply concerned with the well-being of others. Better my glasses. Okay, focus. Luster is about things that go. This includes cars, trucks, planes, and the digging machines that are in the picture book he read with his son at bedtime when he was young. Don's book is also about bigger machines, turbines, the machine of a freeway a man enters in a daily commute, whole cities, the technological wonders that streamline our lives or keep us alive, like the machine inside a man, a new mainspring for the clock of the heart. There are also, he cautions, the killing machines we have made, the missiles that will conduct their unimaginable business on land, obliterating roads, hospitals, power plants, the very factories where they were made, while a few men, our boyish lieutenant, others in subs, the president soaring in his fabulous getaway plane, carry out arcane rituals of analysis and command. This is a vision of invulnerable continuity, he writes. A romance of naive technology that Don's new book calls passionately into question. Perhaps even more than the things we've made, Don's interested in us, the makers, the machine of the human mind, the engine of thought itself, that plant, that power grid, as he calls it, the source of language and memory, two other subjects he explores in depth in this book. This book is filled with gorgeous poems about the narrator's past. Some of my favorites are set in Europe, especially France. In a sequence of poems titled Etudes, he writes of a cafe called La Clairière. In memory, I know even the clatter of small white cups on their saucers, the hurried cube of sugar, and the ordinary spoon will matter. The copper-colored bar will gleam, and the street outside beyond the plate glass wall, a trough of shade between gray 19th century buildings will break into light. Here, it's clear why he's titled his book Luster. Yes, the machines of our making shine, if often with a metallic luster that we should suspect. But trust the gleam of the moment, he suggests. Those we remember and reflect upon, and the one we're entering right now. The moment, he continues, that will open with the same fresh promise streaming from the two spouts of the espresso machine, the gurgling pipe of steamed milk shouting to the day, huddled conversations, hellos, goodbyes. As morning sweeps us on, the warm cup balanced in my thumb and forefinger, and the taste, direct and supple, deepening with the will to meet the day in its changes, not to arrange, fix, or clarify, but to spend even now what memory would hoard. Lifted to light, Don writes in the final poem of this book, such moments gleam with the variegated luster of everything we've made. Let me present now the maker of these lines and all the other thoughtful, beautiful poems in Luster, Don Bogan.
Well, thank you for that lovely introduction. It's really an honor and a pleasure to be here. I've heard a lot about this series, and it's a great delight to be here with Allison and Jason and Michelle, who is actually really from Cincinnati. I've only lived in Cincinnati 30 years. And also to think that I met Allison, I can't believe it was 10 years ago, in Kansas City. I think it was where the AWP was. So it's a real pleasure. I'm delighted to be here. I want to start, I'll read mostly from this new book, Luster, and then I'll work a couple newer things and older things in. But I want to start with a poem that starts the book. I've been interested in writing about objects of various sorts for quite a while, and this can be objects, living things as well as non-living things. And I'll read one living thing first, and then I'll read a non-living thing. This one's called Thoroughbreds. Blood flares from the nostrils. The lungs, the enormous watermelon bellows, are lined with it. Legs, conduits, heart stalks that throb with each pulse, each leap into air and two-beat thump back on earth. Their genes are a careful proposition. They carry their sires like totems in their names. Their blood is as stylized as a strut. Veins push out a nest of tubes to tunnel the meat, branch like ivy stems beneath the drawn skin. Nothing in nature reflects their taut poise. In the boxes, in the small rings with their necks enclasped by wreaths, they skitter, coltish, annoyed. On the track, they glide. Fluidity comes with their lineage. Training sharpens the point. In the dust and rumble of the furious brief loop, their purpose may seem blurred. The curt whip speaks to them. Their flanks are an argument with friction, the structure of their haunches an investment. Robed in shining blankets, they wait like fabulous emissaries from another world. The heart lifts with their promise. Windows slam at their start. And this is a study of an inanimate object. And I, when I first started doing these a long time ago now, I used to say in readings, you know, that I write about everyday objects you see around the house, and then I'd read a poem called Blowtorch, and everybody would sort of look at me like... And it occurred to me that I think people were thinking I meant flamethrower or something. My dad's a handyman, and I, you know, blowtorch is a little tiny thing that, you know, used to weld and such with. So then I stopped saying that I wrote about everyday objects, and I was thinking about the things that have attracted me or that I've been successfully able to make into a poem. And it occurred to me that a lot of them, like thoroughbreds, are basically compound words of two different things put together. And so this is another one. And it's sort of an attempt to figure out the function and meaning of something that's actually common but also a little odd. And the poem's called Bullhorn. A gun for the mouth. It sleeps in a drawer, dangles ready for work, off the lead cop's belt by the nightstick and black can of mace. Big metal nipple with a mesh you put your lips up to, wrist strap, battery in the handle. Letters felt-tipped or stenciled on mark who owns it and what it will defend. It clears its throat with a click, squawk of incipient feedback. You are in violation. Not a bull's sloppy bellow, not a horn either, like that tenor sax singing under the bridge, but the dry slap of authority claimed from a distance. At times it seems a neutral tool, heroic even, calling out to the lifeboat through fog or reaching up into a smoldering sixth-floor room. A searchlight in rubble, its shout awakes the nearly dead. But, your attention, please, it always makes you jump. A warning, flattened, mechanical, a half-displayed threat of force, like a robot speaking through the grill of a truck. The assistant principal scouts the halls, her finger on the trigger. A crackle. Soon she will get to bark. This book has a number of poems set in the past, having just been through an election. I don't know if this state gets tired of being, you know, branded one of these villainous red states that, you know, have led us with another four more years of the current administration. But Ohio certainly has, you know, the number of friends I have on both coasts saying, why did you do this? It's not my fault. But it's interesting. This is a poem that's set actually 50 years ago, and it might unfortunately be somewhat relevant today. It's my attempt to sort of imagine New York intellectuals in the Cold War years. And it starts with an epigraph from Robert Lowell, which unfortunately is probably still relevant today. The poem's called Cocktail Party 1953. Here's the Lowell epigraph. And the Republic summons Ike, the mausoleum in her heart. 0 hour, he pours. Wet fire splits night from day, a ribbon of red gold cutting its road again between the hills of ice. White blocks, then chunks of glass with little cracks, at last amorphous rounded lumps, slippery, voluble. Now he loosens his tie and paces among the suits and stiff bras past the buffet, the ashtrays on chair arms and end tables, blurred drops spattered across blonde curves. His brain is a jewel in flames, revolving, pulsing light long after the nation's asleep. His heart is an underground test, his drink missile fuel. Ideas flare through the rooms like meteors above the luminous city below. That critic slashing air, historian on the rise, hot editor, the host of a dozen scenes like this, he moves from star to star, the fever of their talk simmering his dreams. Cold War ambitions flit among the gossip and smoke, the snack cart, the help, a wife set off on the couch like a glazed tulip. The best minds of an age are sparring here. Aglow inside the brilliant ring, He rattles ice and starts his preemptive strike of talk. No need. She shows her hand. A melting stare, plump lips, burnished, gleaming red, the chalice of her dress where he would sip. I want to move back to my first book now, which was not actually written in the 1950s, does refer to the most significant musical experience of my early youth. And that is seeing Elvis Presley on the Ed Sullivan Show. I have to drink some water before this. And looking at this audience, I guess I don't need to explain the Ed Sullivan Show. I've read sometimes with younger I'm not insulting people here. With people for whom you have to explain it. And the weird thing about it is that suddenly you explain it, you realize what a bizarre show that was, that it was sort of like a weird circus on Sunday nights where, you know, this guy would come on and say, it's a really big show, and there would be, you know, a juggler, and then there'd be a commercial break, and there'd be a magician or something, and then there would be some singer, and sometimes somewhat serious things. But at the end, he always had these popular performers, and when Elvis was on the show, it was considered quite shocking because, as you know, Elvis, the first sort of white performer to make use of African-American rhythms and gestures and all kinds of other stuff in mainstream Sunday night, of all things, family culture in the Eisenhower years. So this is a poem about that experience. It is, for those who are counting appropriately enough, in ballad form. And it's called All Shook Up. Elvis couldn't twitch a hip, or Ed would get the sack. So they bundled his dream thighs in flabby charcoal slacks and tried to keep the cameras high while Ed paced in the wings, glaring at the monitors where Elvis snarled, beating sweat on a curled lip. Four aging sharkskin crooners hummed chords to muffle the beat, blurred in swing harmony like some USO group, sweet as Cairo. The fat microphone was too far off to grab. The slung guitar he'd brought from home was cut off at the strap. The drab curtain just waited to drop. So did Ed. His really big show was floating at the top of Eisenhower Sundays. Who could know the tiny screens would pop, the cloth-smothered speakers split with the news that we were all shook up? I make a kind of weird transition from a very old poem to a fairly new poem. This is another formal poem, but a form that is completely, sort of don't try this at home sort of form. It's called the Paradell. Some of you may have come across it. As its title suggests, it's a made-up thing, made up by the former poet laureate Billy Collins. And I was teaching a Billy Collins book once, I don't quite know why, but in a class, and I had a student who got enamored of this particular form, and I said, yeah, when I tell you the rules, you'll see it's a totally absurd thing. And so interested in that, she wrote many, many of these things. And she eventually contracted a publisher and decided to make an anthology of these paradells. And I remember talking to her. I said, Terry, I think it's called a paradell, I think he kind of, and it has this, he gave a little history to it, that it came from Provence like all the other forms and all that. And had this, and, I think he's kind of pulling her leg and said, I don't know. So eventually she got this anthology together and she asked me to write one. And finally Billy Collins sort of fessed up and now he's going to write an introduction to the anthology. It is a totally absurd form, and I'll explain it to you. It's a little like a kind of sestina, like there's a lot of repetition, but it involves, or like a villanelle, it involves repetition of whole lines. And so what you do is you write, it's four stanzas of six lines each. You write a line, that's line one, you repeat it, that's line two, easy enough. You write another new line, that's line three, you repeat it, that's line four. Then lines five and six are made up of all the words in the lines you wrote, and only those words, in some other combination. So you do that three times. That gives you three stanzas. And then your fourth stanza, as you might imagine, is made up of all the words
in all the new lines that you wrote all the way through. So I thought, you know, interesting challenge. But I'm not particularly creative at thinking these things up, so I decided my little variation would be to use, for those lines that you're supposed to make up, I'm going to be lazy and just use lyrics from rock and roll songs. So that's what I'm doing here. And the title is A Steal from Little Richard. Good golly. Just to dance with you is everything I need. Line one. Just to dance with you is everything I need. Love, love me do. You know I love you. Love, love me do. You know I love you. And the closing two lines. I know I need everything with you, just you. To dance is love, love, love. You do me. Second stanza. I can mash potato. I can do the twist. I can mash potato. I can do the twist. It won't be long now. Yeah, yeah, yeah. It won't be long now. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, I mash potato. Can, can. Yeah, yeah. Now the twist. I won't be doing it long. Oh, dear. What can the matter be? Oh, dear, what can the matter be? That's when my love comes tumbling down. That's when my love comes tumbling down. Matter, the tumbling. When my dear comes down, oh, that's what love can be. Last stanza. Do you love me now that I can dance? I need everything to matter, dear. Do you? The mashed potato can, yeah. The twist, yeah. Love can, yeah, I know it. What comes when love is long won't just be tumbling. Love, oh my, is I be down with you. That's a, you know, first and last paradox for me. I want to move a little bit beyond that kind of pop culture to another one, which is movies. This is a poem that has its origin in watching a lot of television. I finally figured out why I ended up doing this. It was because our daughter was really young, and my wife had a class or something on Saturday mornings, and she was at the age where, you know, she would play, but you would sort of have to play with her, but the way she was playing was boring enough that you could also have television on behind you. I have to say this, I'm a bad parent here. But for some reason, on Saturday mornings, they had all these Johnny Weissmuller Tarzan movies. So I ended up watching all of them. And it was interesting. I used to love the books when I was a kid, but of course the movies are very, very different. And this is just sort of an attempt to talk about those movies. And as you probably know, he was an athlete. An Olympic swimmer, actually, and then he fell into this role, and that was the only thing he ever really did. I think later he became Jungle Jim. He put his shirt back on after he got too flabby to be Tarzan anymore, but sort of set the tone for those kind of strange movies. It's set in Southern California, and I think it's fairly clear. There's only one slight reference. The Brown Derby was a kind of stylish restaurant, I think, in Beverly Hills or something in the 30s and 40s. And it starts with an epigraph from Weissmuller himself. It's called The Moon in the Water. And the epigraph is, how can a guy climb trees, say, me Tarzan, you Jane, and make a million? It was like stealing. That man jogging half naked through the arboretum is the relic of an Olympic swimming star. His amplified yowl swings through arroyos of yucca like a demented cry of triumph or a curse. Rich, flat, comfortable in black and white, he poses before invisible charging rhinos, talks to chimps, and seems a bit lost in his voluminously stylish suit when he dines at the Brown Derby after work. He is not, after all, the articulate slumming aristocrat of the books. His character is a sack of air, and the pidgin English he is made to blurt nails him to a cliché. The bad natives, all spidery body paint and dangling skulls, are undoubtedly more civilized, hence corrupt. On the other side, he is elevated above those good but dumb pack bearers by his instinctual cunning and astounding white skin. In the tank scenes, he resembles a furless otter and is most at home. Frolicking with boy or miming a furious breaststroke with a knife between his teeth, he looks as if he could hold his breath forever. His sleek thighs glisten among the treasure chests and drugged alligators. His feet seem webbed. Free inside the glass-walled river, he is able to transform sport into his own kind of performing art. When he breaks the surface and crawls to some convenient rocks, there is a moment of primitive beefcake he has to enjoy. Then Jane calls, the soggy domestic comedy of a jungle bungalow. Servants monkeying around, minor annoyances at mealtimes, and today, problems with the vine and pulley dumbwaiters that make the whole house work. Ungawa, he sputters at the pygmy elephant tangled in his bamboo harness. Ungawa, a frustrated husband blowing his top. These carefully rehearsed explosions titillate. Eyes a charming smolder, hands caught in a half clench. Then, at last, the relief of a long dream swing across the process screen. Tension and release. Confinement and escape. But the main theme is greed. Ambitious cockneys, spider women, and proto-Nazis scramble for the rhinestone in a plaster idol's eye, then fall off cliffs or get swallowed in the ubiquitous quicksand again and again. Old Janes and boys gone whiskery circle his chest like asteroids. A slew of Wagneroid mood music muddies his classic lines. In the hectic late films, he finds himself drawn to the opulent simplicity of the elephant's graveyard. When they take him at last, like King Kong, to the big city, he responds with a 35-second swan dive off the Brooklyn Bridge. Watch now. His street clothes are sinking in the East River. His pale arm arcs like a slice of moon. Let's see. I'll just read a few more. This is a somewhat different poem related to memory, and also, I guess, related to this question of writing about objects and the sort of strengths and limits of that. And it is called The Objects. These objects that come when I call but never speak. A milkshake glass, hooded sweatshirt, handmade paperweight, lonely among garrulous memories. They cut out a hole around them, like a man in a white field, a man behind the wheel of a car. Because they are piled up, they are disconnected. Because they are solid, they seem unreal. Artifacts gathered for the journey near the scarabs and terracotta jars. Old toys, photographs, family stories have chattered into silhouettes. A clutter of things that will survive me turns away, dragging a little scar across the past. I'll close with a few poems about places. This one is about the place where I spent the worst years of my life, junior high school and high school, Southern California. And I think the thing when I go back there, I appreciate it more having now lived in Cincinnati for almost 30 years. But it's so sleepy. I mean, it's just, you know, it's like people talk about the Midwest as being, you know, kind of backwards and slow and sleepy, but boy, Southern California, at least Pasadena, where my folks live, is just very, very sleepy. This poem is called Stucco. Morning sky, the San Gabriel's amazingly visible, eggplant and faded butter tones lumping on the horizon, the pale khaki dot of a yucca, and higher, a green line of scraggly firs. Palms parade down the foothills. Then the short, tough grasses, hybrid, exotic, defining empty lawns. Wide streets sleeping in, walkways curve among the rose bushes. These bungalows bleaching for 70 years, round arches, porches designed for awnings no longer there. In the foot-thick stucco walls, a blunt hint of adobe anchors the revival. Always this nod to a mythic past, thin dreams of realtors inscribed in the layered crust. Light streams and wavers, all the smooth cream-colored surfaces mottled and pitted. A certain broad dryness is spreading in the sun, capacious, democratic, and matte. I've been interested for a while in certain kinds of public forms and public poetry, and I got intrigued by a very unfashionable poet, Alexander Pope, and the sort of verse epistle idea. It would help if I turned to the right page. And as you probably know, Pope wrote in rhymed couplets, closed rhymed couplets, and though I wasn't able to do that, I tried to work a little bit with the idea of the couplet and with the meter. And to try to write a verse epistle about city life, people have described Cincinnati as sort of, you know, St. Louis East or Milwaukee South or something. And I think there's a lot of things that are shared with St. Louis. It's a river city, a little bit smaller, it has hills, and it's, I guess, slightly older, but not a whole lot older. Very much a neighborhoody kind of place. And with the usual problems of rising and falling and urban life and other things as well, gentrification things. And so this is a poem in the atmosphere or in the style of Pope. And I'll read this one, then I'll follow by a very short one, then I'll be out of here. It is a verse epistle. It's addressed to a former colleague of mine who taught the 18th century. I did once read something, and somebody asked me, they thought, who is this Dr. Venturo person? They thought it was something like they should have a footnote for it. No, it's just a guy that I used to talk with about Alexander Pope. And it follows the tradition of addressing the person. It's a verse letter, basically, to this person who teaches in another place now. Epistle to Dr. Venturo. Throw down your books. You've planned enough for class. Your students won't be dazzled any less for time you might spend picking up the news of happenings where little ever does. What are friends for? To call you from your work, recalling friendship with each brief remark, to fill you in and fill in the details of spots unchanged and changes time reveals. If classic poets turned away from Rome could hold forth on the world from one small farm, then our provincial outpost might provide some light and lines you get to read, not grade. My theme is cities, how they rise and fall by laws of nature or by loss of will, by planning in good sense or dollars and cents, by history's dictates or the whims of chance. Whatever occurred, a city seeking growth will clean its past and package it as truth. Take this one, river trade, then pigs, then soap, a creek bed lined with factories sprouting up, a booster spirit fattening each year, dressed now for market in a dream brochure. Venturo, come discover our new line, a hint of chic enlarded in each claim. See, Rome on the Ohio, or at least the San Francisco of the Middle West. A city does not blossom, it is built. Its body is geography and wealth. Where hilltops rise above a sick morass, a city view becomes the best address. To see, not smell, catch light instead of smog, requires a Jaguar and a Persian rug, a wine rack, wet bar, shelves of gleaming loot that complement the claims of real estate. When cities age, their history grows dear. The heights become antiques, the pits obscure. Old names, old top spots in this city's past are what her newest suitors value most. Thus, Clifton, i.e. Clifftown, Indian Hill, Mount Airy with its promise never stale, heights, peaks, runs, parks, assorted terraces, and Mount Healthy, the most ingenuous. A mountain or a molehill's a safe bet. Where burghers feared to tread, the ground was flat. They left the basin to escape disease. The new escapees glide by on freeways. The past lies all before them, where to choose well-tended slopes that help investments rise. Now let's descend for local atmosphere. Breathe deeply. There is something in the air. It drifts through ozone, floating on a breeze of hydrocarbons, mist, suspended grease, past rib pits, rusting playgrounds, parking lots, a scabrous billboard hawking cigarettes, Chevys on blocks, one skittering brown dog, street kids and drunks awake enough to beg. Collected, dense, familiar, it will rise into the convolutions of the nose, then drop, then spread out as it speeds along to graze the fragile blossoms of each lung and ride the blood until it finds its own niche in the chemical storeroom of the brain. Thus great pollution sweeps past every eye to stir the heart and take our breath away. But stay downtown, Venturo, and look up, where tax abatements gather all our hope. As aging streets, like bodies, thrive or rot, some buildings fall, and some rejuvenate. A tenement turns condo, news reports, and tenants load their goods in shopping carts. A wall is stripped, fine plasterwork revealed, officials paid off, old contracts annulled, old ceilings shown, old residents shown out, floors newly sanded, and new closings set. While gilded doormen scan the lowering street, Art Deco elevators trace the height, the broadening suites, the dear amenities expanding as the asking prices rise, till at the top, glassed, staring at the sun, gleam pools, a jogging track, and health salon. The ski machines, the splendid rowers shine, and sweat glows like a polish on each tan. What's steep stays clean. A rich aerobic food scours the narrow passageways of blood, beats back the years, builds confidence anew, and helps the highest ever still to grow. A city learns to lift its searching eyes and tune its voices upward into praise. Oh, brave repurchased Eden, looming clear, cloud-spanning airy, palace of pure air, where bright, forever young gods of the hill may sport at their own sweet will. And one last one, also kind of city, but slightly more personal, kind of a paranoid poem, I think. I have the good fortune to be able to walk to work. But the problem is that I have to walk up a very busy street, and the drivers in Ohio are probably even more oblivious, at least following the general pattern of the farther east you go, the worse the drivers get, more oblivious than the drivers here in St. Louis. So you have to be very, very careful. This is a poem called Pedestrian Song. I'll close with that one. Eyes behind car windows don't want to see you. Lungs don't breathe your air. The head a bland globe in the glare of glass, neck a stick, spine a stick, limbs four sticks tipped in pads, rods, and hooks to press, twist, swivel. Crab in the shell, pale brain in the skull, that wriggling thing cased in bright metal follows the lights 12 feet up out of this world. Where is it going in its carton of steel, the body transformed to a blunt dream? It shines in the dark, high beam, low beam, nosing a course focused as a shark's through a shipwreck. You can't predict it. The signs flash clear, don't walk, don't walk. You can smell the heat from their hoods. You can hear valves snapping as they wait along the faint line that keeps you safe. Oh, you are soft, tiny as a rabbit, your only defense a tissue of faith. Stay quick, then. If you think there's a person in there, look again. Think back to your own long spin, secure, controlled, in touch with the wheel, then reeling and screeching till at last you can stop and the whole world starts up around you. Thanks very much. Just in time. Thanks very much.